Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian who survived a coma. And on this show, I talk to artists and organizers about death, art, politics, and the events that define our lives. Lee Claire, I did not mean to confuse you when I welcomed the listeners and you're but I appreciate you you jumping in. I've got Lee Claire LaBerge with me, author of many books, but Fake Work, How I Began to Suspect Capitalism as a Joke is the one that I read recently. And it's your most recent, right?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
Very excited to have you. I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Before we do anything, though, I want to jump right in and ask you what you hope happens when you die.
I guess I would say the first thing that comes to mind is relief from anxiety.
Okay. Anxiety feels like a life-defining thing to you?
You know, it's a very interesting time to be having this conversation. We were supposed to have it, I think, 2 weeks ago. And my elderly mother fell, and I canceled our appointment. And then last week, or actually the day after I canceled that appointment, I got the results from a mammogram that said we found an area of concern, and you need to come back for further imaging. And I could not get that. I could not get the second appointment for 9 days. So in the time since we were supposed to talk and now, I've gone through this experience of like intense anxiety related to not, you know, any kind of sense of imminent mortality, but the specter of it. And then just Friday, so a few days ago, I had the follow-up imaging, and I was given, you know, a free pass. When you ask the question, the first thing that came to mind was, oh my God, like that, the anxiety last week was so intense. And while I was in it, I thought, well, God, if the worst comes to pass, I would be released from this feeling. I'm in a very Kierkegaardian moment of, you know, a post Kierkegaardian moment, but fear and trembling, fear and dread, anxiety, that would be the deliverance. I don't yet have the time and space to, you know, imagine the Elysian Fields or something like that.
Sure, sure. Well, but it's really interesting too, that the anxiety is almost about the uncertainty more than anything else, because the minute you find out, you're describing a release from anxiety.
Right, right.
Either way, you're saying even if the worst happens, I could find a way to accepting.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. Well, I think that's the sort of sine qua non of anxiety, right? The state of unknowing and waiting and the time between the now and then. You know, that's the sort of... like Walter Benjamin had that favorite line, time is the gambler's narcotic, you know, but it's also the anxiety haver's narcotic. It's also what makes it possible and then what ultimately suspends the feeling, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But that makes it, the narcotic makes it sound like a thing you would choose at any point.
Also something that would dull the pain, right?
So right.
Sort of both ways, yes. But no, it's an interesting time to be having these questions asked.
So you would hope for a release of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else to not, it doesn't have to be Elysian Fields-ish, but is there, do you imagine... In this hope still, because this is my way of like dodging any strict materialists from like being like, I don't think it's anything, you know. And I'm just like, well, I didn't ask what you think. I asked what you hoped, you know, in your fearful and trembling heart.
Are you, did you just breathe in deeply?
I did. I love the rejoinder that you knew the materialist answer. I love that.
Well, yeah, of course. But I guess the question is there, do you have a desire for like a consciousness that is free of anxiety? Or if getting rid of anxiety means getting rid of your consciousness, is that also okay?
It would be the latter.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
It would be the latter. And you know, the reason I said I love the materialist, I guess it's not a rejoinder, but it's a hedge. It's like, is there anything that will prevent you from going down the same road that I get when I ask any materialist this question, which is death is a kind of nothingness. And so there's mm-hmm. no sort of hope. And I have to sort of plead guilty and say it's been such a part of my belief system for so long that I have a very sort of uncreative answer to it. And then probably if I hadn't had this experience of intense anxiety for the past 10 days, I would have had even a less creative answer.
Well, then I'm really glad that happened to you.
Thanks.
Yeah. No, but that is, so you've gotten a lot of comfort from the idea of like, this is it. There's a finite period of time. This is when I'm fitting in the things that are me.
I don't know if I would say comfort.
Okay.
But I would say there's a kind of boundedness that that I've long accepted and never felt encouraged or curious to challenge. You know, it seems such a kind of, it seems so axiomatic for my my life and my worldview. And, you know, I do think there's a kind of relationality that people who are still alive have with those people who have passed.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
that's a bit of a different answer than the question that you asked, you know, which would be totally. To continue to be spoken to or spoken with or spoken about. But I don't know that that's my hope. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You've felt this way for such a long time. Did you grow up with any sort of, like, did it take some undoing to get to this place? Or were you just like, from the beginning, my parents were pretty secular, it just felt natural?
You know, my father was sent to Catholic boarding school his whole life. So he was sort of a survivor. I mean, he was about as secular as anybody could be, but especially coming out of a Catholic boarding school. And my mother, it's interesting. I'm working on a new book now actually about my mother and about mortality and illness in many ways. And part of that book is my mother has dementia. And she was a historian herself, and she was a great keeper of journals. And so part of that book is I'm reading all of her journals and writing about things that she wrote about. And she was quite religious. I never realized this, or maybe my sister, father, and I were just also secular. We didn't even have room to see it, but she never sort of, you know, forced it on us. And we went to church a few times, and then I think when I was 9 or 10, she said, well, you've got to decide, do you want to go on your own or do you just want to quit going? And I thought, I'm done. You know, that's the easiest choice I've ever had to make. And there's never been a draw to it. There's never been a challenge. I also don't have friends who have a sense of a kind of afterlife.
Sure.
So it's very underdeveloped for me as an area of concern or even curiosity almost.
Yeah. This is in the book, the thing that I'm really fascinated with Marx and Marxism as someone who initially somehow I was able to avoid, I took all the required classes that didn't read Marx in college, or read like the Communist Manifesto. and didn't, I didn't have a sense of like, cause what you're, and correct me if you feel like I'm like mischaracterizing your writing in any way, but it feels like you're really reckoning with, you are working at this company that's preparing for Y2K, and in the process, realizing that you didn't have the framework for understanding the world mm-hmm. that you now have. And some of that has to do with Marxist ideas. And yeah.
Yeah. Some of it has to do with, a lot of it has to do with a liberal arts education.
Sure.
And, you know, I think your description is quite apt that you took all the classes. Maybe you read the Communist Manifesto, maybe not, but there's not a reckoning with kind of like what would it mean to think about a political economy, you know, to think about capitalism as an object of inquiry. Somehow you can mm-hmm. you can have a very robust liberal arts education that skirts around that, and you don't realize that you are skirting around it, you know? I mean, and then in my case, it wasn't until I started working at this, you know, Fortune 500 company that I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
How is this possible?
Although you got there.
How does this work?
One of the weirdest things to me is I'm like, you really wanted to be a businessman? That is what
100%.
I find that so 100%. Hard to believe. Like, I guess just from having like met you and the book is like funny and I'm like, no way. No, you really wanted to? That's like so hard for me. It's so strange to me.
It was such a genuine desire to sell out. And
is that
it
like
was
a contrarian
only,
impulse at all?
I think it has to be. I think okay. it has to be. And I think I talk about that a little bit in the book. I think I say, you know, is it a kind of sense of undiagnosed, like oppositional defiant
right,
disorder
right.
or,
yeah.
you know, something of that sort. Yeah, I think it has to be. But at the same time, if your contrarian impulse is the impulse that is, you know, encouraged and supported.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the absolute sort of ultimate infrastructure of modernity, then it doesn't necessarily appear as a contrarian impulse, right?
Totally.
Yes, but I think absolutely, you know, in retrospect, yes, 100%.
Well, I think the thing I'm interested in about your relationship to Marx and Marxism is you talk at some point in the book about how Marxists don't like, there's not a ton of room for humor, for personal mm-hmm. reflection. You talk mm-hmm. about one of them just like shitting on the Atlantic Ocean as like a shit ocean or like
a bullshit ocean.
And so it's like, and so what I see you doing in this book is using this idea. I'm really like, I'm feeling like overly self-conscious about the words I'm using. So I'm just going to use words and just correct me. Feel free to like correct me on the most basic level if you need to. You're using this ideology that I don't associate with much like as a vehicle for memoir, but you're using it and reckoning with it as a vehicle mm-hmm. for memoir. And as someone who didn't have a ton of real reckoning with Marxy ideas, I hear Marxism and the like little evangelical kid I was growing up hears like, oh, this is an ideology named around one single guy, like alert, you know? And I understand from like having talked to people that it's like, it's not even about him. It's a whole way of thinking, blah, blah, blah. But like, I guess, could you help me understand I guess just to give you props for like working through that in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But also what your relationship is to someone's idea of like Marxism that you have come to through the act of being a person who is familiar with these ideas but is writing about your own life?
Yeah. I think the way you started off that question by saying you're taking this philosophical tradition of Marxism and using it as a sort of vehicle or a sort of device for memoir is totally correct. It's totally correct from a formal point of view. That's how the book is sort of structured. But it's also correct, or it's also historically correct, from my own autobiography, from my own trajectory. Like, I think, you know, there's another aspect of my contrarianism, right? It's one contrarianism is to get into a Fortune 500 company, and then another one is to be there and start thinking, my God, like, if this is the way the global economy is structured, then I got to read something else. Like, this is surreal. And this was a sort of surreal moment of Y2K, and the job that I was in was absolutely bonkers. And I did, you know, literally nothing, and no one did anything, and we were all compensated very well. But but the level of just sort of absolute indulgence and expenditure, and the fact that that then is what led me to start to think about Marxism has its own sort of contrarian impulse.
Yeah, why would that even be the thing that you jump to? Yeah,
right. Because I could have very easily said, you know, this is great. Like, I'm not turning back. My God, I mean, this is how these people live. But that didn't happen. And within a few months, I was quite bored of the job and of the work that I was doing. And, you know, but I think the interesting thing is that it was in this sort of corporate crucible of like apocalyptic scenarios combined with deep, deep boredom that I learned to, I think, find the voice of a writer, and that I began to write, which again has its own contrarian aspect to it. But the job gave me the kind of time and space to start to think about language, words, narratives, and for that I'm deeply appreciative. And I didn't know during the course of the job, I didn't know while I was working at this Fortune 500 company, okay, like what I'm missing is a sort of Marxist genealogy of economic critique. And in the book, even I talk about trying to recruit, you know, my sort of philosophical repertoire, the one I had when I was 21, 22, 23, whether it's Foucault or Jacques Derrida or Plato or Aristotle. I mean, I was a philosophy major. That's who I read. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to recruit them in the service of critique, in the service of what we call critical thinking, right? Where you can take an object from outside a scenario, apply it to a scenario, and have a sort of synthetic experience of understanding. And it was only when I sort of was repeatedly coming up short that I thought, okay, something is missing here. And it's probably within me. I mean, something is definitely missing within the company. But now that I'm trying to think about what it is, something is missing within me.
And to be clear, when you say you're trying to think about what it is, it's like,
yeah,
what is the question that you were asking? Just like, why does this feel so strange?
So I was hired as a, you know, 22-year-old with a philosophy degree from Hampshire College to essentially compare printed out spreadsheets, Excel spreadsheets with a database and see where the spreadsheets matched up and where they didn't. Yeah. And that was how this company was going to approach Y2K, this fear that the world might end on, you know, 1201 or whatever on January 1st, 2000. And after a while I realized, and they would talk about the fact, my colleagues, like, look, it's not really we're not really trying to solve Y2K. What we're really trying to do here is if this company gets sued for a kind of Y2K problem, we'll be able to at least mount a good defense and say, look, we created a paper trail. I mean, so much of corporate and white collar labor is just producing unnecessary texts and then copying them and editing them and recopying them and storing them. And so that's already a very like literary disposition, right? I mean, you're in, you're in a text. That's what you're doing. And there was a real sort of nihilism and boredom to that. But because this company was a global company, because it was a, you know, it's a company that has, it's a media communications and advertising company. It has about, when I was working there, it had about 1,100 offices all over the world. It wasn't enough just to sit in our skyscraper in New York City and compare spreadsheets with a database. But we took our show on the road and we flew all over the world. And, you know, I flew to Johannesburg for a 20-minute meeting, right? Just because they needed somebody to, they needed to say, someone went to Johannesburg and said, hey, shape up, you know, or hey, guys.
We showed you the here, PowerPoint with the duck on it or whatever.
Sharing a PowerPoint, right.
Yeah.
And so this, this change from like this, just this like the most horrible like data entry to I spent 6 months in the company of these corporate consultants flying all over the world, you know, first class, business class, staying at the Ritz-Carlton in Hong Kong. I mean, it was this incredible experience of like a Bildungsroman-esque, like, what 22-year-old, what 23-year-old does not want that, you know, going out to $1,000 dinners? I mean, I had nothing even to compare it to. It was all so surreal. And then it was like, I mean, while this was happening, I was thinking like, how is this capitalism? How is this, how does this even approximate buying and selling and wage labor and education? Like, what is this? This is a performance of something, or this is an aberration, or if this is not an aberration, then really what is this? Like, how could this possibly be the way that the edifice that structures capitalist modernity is run? Like, how is that possible? And it was in trying to figure that out that I realized, oh, like, I need to have some understanding of, I wouldn't have said Marxism or political economy, but I would have said the economy, because I wanted to write a book about this experience. And I started writing a book about it. And I took these notes while I was there. It ended up taking me about 25 years to finish it, which is itself an interesting, you know, creative process.
Well, and I liked, it's nice to have, as someone who on this podcast is like constantly talking about how I'm making the podcast, and self-consciously with a fear that people are getting like bored of that and are like, we're already listening, relax, you know, but you're to be reckoning with your book, in the midst of writing the book, and you don't quite have like a Frankenstein style, like book within a book, but you do.
No,
the book is a character in your book.
Yes.
And that is, it's cool. And I like that kind of breakdown of form.
Yeah. And I think what I liked about it is, you know, I took these obsessive notes, like, what is the airport like in Auckland, New Zealand? What's the business class lounge like in Heathrow? What's the, you know, what does an advertising agency look like? And then I didn't really use them for about 20 years, but to be able to go back to this earlier iteration, not only of myself, but this archive in this world that doesn't, it's not quite familiar to me anymore, but the voice of me that wrote those things is familiar to me. And to be able to move between these different aspects of my own voice and my own experience, you know, one side having this, again, this like edifice of corporate global capitalism that I was in, but couldn't understand, versus the other side, the sort of beyond it, where I'm like, well, now I have a pretty good understanding of it, but I'm not really in it anymore in the same way. Like it's right. it's not what I hope. I mean, obviously I'm a participant in it. We all are, but
yeah.
It's not what I'm devoting myself to. It's not what I'm hoping for. It's now an object of critique. Whereas before, when I was working in it, it was an object of desire and an object of excitement. Mm-hmm. And even when it was disappointing and boring and banal, like those feelings were still deeply felt because I was so disappointed. I was like, I wanted more from this, you know, like I thought I would get more out of it. How can it be that now I'm just sitting here comparing two spreadsheets?
Right. Well, so now that you do have some of the rubric that you didn't have when you were first there, what has that rubric given you in terms of self-knowledge? What have the big philosophical or political economy ideas given you mm-hmm. in terms of self-knowledge?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the biggest one is that what the sort of system of contemporary capitalism demands from white collar workers or from workers in the global capitalist North is it demands a kind of structure of life in which one's time and one's sense of time is slowly compromised. So the sense that your time is not your own and that there's not enough time, mm-hmm. that there's a kind of scarcity to time. That is something that, that you get in some of Marx's writing. I mean, he's really more interested in the labor process, and in the way the sort of system, structures itself and sort of adheres as a form of global domination where you can't really choose not to participate in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to sell your labor. That's not an option. You don't have the option to opt out. You have to sell your labor. But so there was that aspect of it. But really, I think what that job gave me was a sense that there's never enough time and that capitalism is an economy of time, of taking your time, of enforcing certain times, of enforcing certain horizons, of the sense that your time is not your own, that you work until you retire, and then you're too tired and you're facing death. I mean, that I know intellectually, and I know that intellectually from reading and, you know, being a professor for the past 20 years. But I also know that phenomenologically and existentially from that experience of corporate work. And the reason it's important is that when I say no one at the job was doing anything, they weren't doing anything, but they were giving their time and they had lost their time and their lives were structured through the act of doing nothing. And through the act of feeling like they had to do that. And they did have to do it. I mean, they didn't have to do it in the exact way they were doing it, but they did have to do it. And it's also given me, I think that experience has given me a lot of sympathy with people whose politics I don't necessarily share, whose worldview I don't necessarily share. I think that, you know, the people that I worked with were... You know, they were business people. I mean, they believed in capitalist firms as an idea of efficiency, as an idea of meritocracy, to which they were ready to devote their lives. And I don't today in my life know a lot of people like that, and I don't choose to associate with a lot of people like that. But I am glad that I had. That experience to sort of, you know, understand how the world can look different. right? And how these things that I perceive as sort of structures of abstract global domination, which might be configured differently, they really do perceive as necessity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important political moment, you know, an intellectual moment too.
Yeah, because you're seeing, because they're, the thing you're bringing to that workplace, one of the things that I very much relate to and am in the midst of struggling with at my actual nonprofit job at the moment, is well, I'll just say, I think this is probably the third episode in a row where I'm referring to, because we're deep enough in the time code and no one at my work listens to this, that they gave me a pay cut, which is about like 12 grand, which is very significant for me. And because they need to, you know, prove whatever to the board. And at the same time, they are raising millions of dollars for a renovation mm-hmm. of the building. And so mm-hmm. I step back and I go, well, these things don't have to be structured in this way. Certainly, if someone is capable of donating millions of dollars, they are also capable of donating several thousands of dollars to keep, you know, an employee so essential they're not even able to fully lay them off, fully employed rather than partially employed. But that is a level of like questioning the very foundation of the system that other people are not able to do. But so what you're able to do is you're able to, they probably can't do the same for you, but you at the very least can look and say, oh, I see all of the things that you take for granted that it's not like a condescension. It's just, it's almost a type of empathy where it's like, I see what is so foundational to your reality that you're unable to question it.
Yeah. And it's definitely not a condescension. And, you know, I
experience it as a condescension.
Okay.
not from you. When I have those thoughts, it's very much like, you fool, question something for once, please.
But I think the reason that the nothingness of the work that I was engaged in and the nothingness of the work that my whole team and my whole office was engaged in, I think the reason that it's so important is that it demonstrates this doesn't matter and it could be different. And your nonprofit's new building doesn't matter and your $12,000 pay cut doesn't matter. I mean, it matters to you. It doesn't matter to them. The new building doesn't matter to them. It doesn't matter to the donor. Who knows why they gave that money? Maybe it's a tax write-off. None of it matter. I mean, it's all ripe for a political recultivation, right? And the left, just as much as anybody else, needs to jettison, you know, terms of efficiency, meritocracy, you know, these are the terms which give us the structure. They do not deliver us from the structure. And I think that's why that's important. And it's been so interesting. You know, when I left this corporate job, I left it in, I guess, 2000. Yeah, I left it shortly after nothing happened. You know, which was its own moment when I walked into work on January 3rd. And it's like, okay, nothing happened. And no one even mentioned it. It's just
exactly.
Like,
and not even like there's no like big shameful moment where everyone's like egg on our face.
Because it didn't matter. Exactly. It could have been a different problem onto the next fake problem. You know, it's one narrative blip after another that structures this accumulation. But since I left that and have been working since in university since then, to slowly watch the universities become more about branding and deliverables and quality assurance and, you know, all of the rest of it. It is a kind of corporate speak and corporate organization. And that's, in a way, to have had that experience working in an actual corporation, you know, I can see the links and I can also see... again, it doesn't, there's no there. Like, I mean, it's an organization of time. It's a rhythm of accumulation. It's an organization of people's lives and existence to maintain a certain kind of, I wouldn't call it efficiency, but a certain kind of capitalist lifestyle. And so here we are. And so here we are again, you know. And, you know, if anything, the thing that's so interesting about having worked at a large corporation like this is like, at least they pay people well. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like they, their lingua franca is money and they do deliver on that in this certain way. I mean, that also has its like, wow, like, you know, they talk the talk and the walk. So there are certain ironies too, you know.
Totally. Let's take a, who knows if this is a detour or not.
Okay.
But I want to ask you another like tentpole question of the podcast, which is what's your coma? By which I mean a moment before which you were one version of yourself and after you were another. Can be big or small. Does not, you know, it can happen in the blink of an eye. It can be a sort of fugue state you went into for 6 months and came out of. Yeah.
But is it coma in the sense of non-consciousness or is it coma in the sense of entering in as one state, leaving as another?
The latter.
The latter. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't associate this at all with being comatose, but, you know, I often say, and I've often narrated this to myself, one of the things I'm very interested in is how people, how I and how other people, how they change their minds.
Yes.
What does it mean to change your mind, right? What does it mean to have, whether it's a Copernican revolution or a comatose period? And I'll give you my top two. And if you're interested in more one or the other, then you can choose.
Okay,
we've already talked about one a little bit, but when I was 24, 25, I was in graduate school and I suffered like a major depression. And I started, after other failed therapies, I started psychoanalysis and I did a psychoanalysis 3 to 4 times a week for about 10 years. And that was absolutely revelatory. I mean, I entered it in one state and sort of came out in another.
Wow.
And the other one would be getting a PhD, right? Like going, you know, spending 7 years reading and writing at a level that I didn't know I could experience and that I sort of fell in love with a sort of certain aspect of my mind. I again entered in one state and came out in another. So I think those are two experiences that I also highlight because I couldn't replicate them if I tried, you know? And I think that's what's sort of interesting about a coma. Hopefully one doesn't fall into it willingly. It happens you and you come out on the other end. And I mean, of course, I entered into psychoanalysis willingly and I entered into a PhD program willingly.
Right.
But what I underwent, I couldn't replicate, but
felt beyond your control in some way.
Yeah. And it felt like I will never have the same quality of, you know, depression in the sense of psychoanalysis that I did before that experience, or I know myself and it was a learning experience in ways to know and sit with myself, that's changed my quality of living, changed my quality of life. Same thing with getting a PhD. You know, there's no going back. I'll never be the person that I was before I had a PhD. But getting one and learning these things and learning what my mind is sort of capable of and ways that I can be creative and challenge myself and engage with the thoughts of others. It's been sort of Copernican. Yeah. And so I would say those are my two comas.
Based on the timeline, it sounds like these were maybe overlapping a bit.
They were. Absolutely.
That's
absolutely
really fascinating. The idea that you're like undergoing distinct transformations at the same time is really, do you connect them in any way?
Oh, completely. You know, because there's such a, there's, you know, there's this idea in the history of like, philosophy that, you know, Marx and Freud deliver the sort of two great like narcissistic wounds to the Western philosophical tradition. You know, Marx says humans make their own history. Humans make their history, but not under the conditions of their choosing. And Freud says, I mean, the metaphor he uses is you're not the master of your own house, right? Like both of them are saying humans are governed both inside their minds and outside it by forces which they can study, they can learn about, they can interact with, but are also beyond their control in many ways. And there's a kind of givenness to the force of the other, whether that's history or other people in one's life, that is, I think, like both deeply humbling and deeply liberating. And so for me, these two sort of ricocheted off each other and went back and forth with each other. And I was in conversation with different aspects of them. I mean, I studied in graduate school psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic theory to some extent, but never with the same like sort of devotion that I did Marxism or the history of political economy. But they both in a way like delivered me from the self-centeredness of adolescence and early adulthood, I would say.
That's what I was going to say. It sounds like a humbling process of sorts.
Deeply, deeply.
So is that the way in which you would describe, and if you need a focal point, we'll focus on the PhD.
Okay.
But is that the way that you would describe who you were before and after, is in terms of that self-centeredness?
A different relationship to it, I would say. I wouldn't say, it's not gone, but it's a different relationship to it. And a
Which
different self-conscious. Well, I think there's a self-consciousness about, you know, when do I make the choice to listen to my own voice versus others? What does it mean to allow other voices into my sort of intellectual pantheon? And how do I bring them in? And how do I judge them? And how do I criticize them? And how do I listen to them? And I think, you know, I think that the sort of great thing about being 22 or 23 and the sort of explosive, I think, and in my case, unwarranted, or probably in most cases unwarranted, absolute narcissistic self-confidence is that it shelters one from a lot and it closes you off to a lot. Mm-hmm. In terms of making judgments, making critiques, learning to understand things about yourself. And for me, the sort of like twin processes of psychoanalysis and getting a PhD were a sort of shedding of that and a sort of letting go of that and making room for like genuine otherness, both in my intellectual life and in my personal life, a sort of otherness that was not as guarded, was not as anxious, was not as panicked. Yeah, that has been like absolutely revelatory.
What do you mean by otherness? Like, what does it mean to make
room? Other people, other experiences, other voices, the ability to change your mind, you know, the ability to realize when and how you're wrong, and to even be able to find some amount of joy and freedom in that. Like, yeah, I was wrong. Yeah. I could have done it differently. I still can. You know, that to me was like life affirming, even if hard, humbling, a narcissistic wound, narcissistic injury. Yes, all of them. Absolutely. But in my sense, like, I think it also ushered in like a new relationship to my creativity and an ability to write differently and an ability to read differently, which in many ways, you know, I'm still asking the same kinds of questions that I was asking as a 22 and 23 year old writing that first iteration of Fake Work, right? What is work? Why does one want it? What does it mean to do it? What does one get from it? How does it change you? But now I ask them, I think, with a lot more sympathy and breadth and depth and scope, and can come back to them and enjoy the iterative process of going back to the same thing and answering it differently, the same question and answering it differently.
Are there specific moments from that PhD or texts or you know, even like discussion moments with other people where you were like, where you had as close as could come to like immediate light bulb sort of like turn on a dime, or you read a phrase and it just like completely, because I've realized recently I've had the experience of like literally, like for me in 2020, my sort of political re-radicalization came from literally reading the word anti-racist, which is not something that like a lot of the like anti-racist stuff is frankly not like radical enough for me at the moment anymore. But just seeing that word reminded me of it. It contained so many ideas of like specifically the idea that it is not enough to not be racist, to not be committing harm. You actually have to actively be doing good or being in solidarity with people. And all of that came from like reading a single word. And were there things like that for you? I mean, I assume there were, but what were some of those things?
Definitely around racial capitalism.
Okay.
You know, it was, the term wasn't anti-race, although I heard that term often.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, just, you know, learning that the critique of capitalism isn't just a critique of an economic system, but of the kind of relations of power that undergird that. And in the case of, you know, the U.S. economy or the Western European economy, that the global north, the history of that is the absolute exploitation of the global south. So racial capitalism was a huge one. You know, I think that one of the things that I still feel appreciative of, I did my graduate work in New York City at NYU. I learned, I mean, I had so many fellow students and professors who were so critical of the police, of the New York Police Department, of policing, and were sort of anti-police activists. And it's funny, when I first heard about that, I was sort of like, well, anti-police, I mean, what are they, what's the problem here? You know, I was so a middle-class white woman.
Yeah.
I was like, what? But that was a huge one. And then having some friends, two in particular, who did anti-prison work and anti-carceral work. I mean, that was another, area in which I was sort of like, what's wrong with prison? You know, where are we supposed to put people? What's wrong with prisons?
Right.
And just to have my mind like open to a totally different understanding of carceral systems and carceral reality. So I think the phrase was like maybe carceral geography. Geographies of incarceration, I forget, but definitely the phrase racial capitalism and, you know, thinking about anti-policing and then anti-carceral work.
When the anti-carceral these were all
just
stuff.
These were all just huge for me. And I can also, you know, look, I grew up in a small town in Appalachian, Virginia, and I can, you know, I often go back there and I can also imagine one version of my life where I don't move to New York City and I don't get the PhD and I'm just like, well, let's build some more prisons, you know? I can imagine this version of my life that is so much less like politically and critically inflected and not open to, well, what is racial capitalism? Why is that a term? What does it mean? That I still feel appreciative. I still feel deeply appreciative of having the experience of reading and, you know, forming a Marx reading group and spending summers in these texts. I mean, it's something that continues to inform me which it feels like such a gift, you know, to be able to have that relationship, not only with people I was in the group with, but with myself, being able to draw on those kinds of conversations and that kind of lineage to situate myself in a present.
Yeah. And I think the, you know, I'm realizing like the thread of our conversation has kind of been the relationship between these big, seemingly impersonal ideas and the ways mm-hmm. in which they can become mm-hmm. really a part of your life. And I think that's
absolutely.
That's why I didn't take the Marx classes, was because I was like, I love art. I want mm-hmm. pure aesthetics, you know, also mm-hmm. a very privileged, like suburban mm-hmm. white boy sort of thing, you know? Mm-hmm. The anti-carceral stuff is interesting because it is so, when you spend time with people who've really done deep anti-carceral work, who've built with people on the inside, and then the way they structure the organizations they're in, the way they talk with their friends, mm-hmm. the way they like, I mean, I have like sort of abolitionist organizer friends who suggest like, oh, you know, I talked to so-and-so about like the ways we can support each other as friends. Do you, you know, do you ever do that with like blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, I don't really know how to broach that with my like fantasy baseball group chat. You know what I mean? It's like not like, like, which not to say like I won't continue to think of ways to try or whatever.
Right.
But it really shows that like the relationship to these institutions mm-hmm. can change how you act interpersonally.
Oh, yes. Yes, completely. But it's also true that plenty of, you know, leftist groups, like, it would be just as hard to talk about it as it would be with your fantasy baseball chat, and are just as riven by true. Homophobia, sexism, and racism as all the rest of it.
Well, I have a pretty woke fantasy baseball chat.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that.
I don't think any more or less than slightly more. I'd say like a 60 percentile woke version.
You know,
average American chat.
I had this like very interesting experience where I published fake work, and you know the company that I worked for. I give it it's anonymized in the book. Yes. I just call it the conglomerate. And all the people's names have been anonymized. And so, you know, the book went through legal review before the publisher and before it was published. And part of it had been published in Harper's and in Plus One. And so I had dealt with fact-checking and with any legal issues. So, I felt pretty confident in it. But it also, I had this anxiety of like, well, on the one hand, these people that I work with, like, they don't read books. I mean, so they're not going to read, like, they're not going to be browsing at an indie bookstore and pick up the latest issue from a socialist press out of Chicago, Haymarket. Mm-hmm. But I just had this anxiety, like, okay. And I remember last June, I did a book launch in New York, and I was getting on the subway after the book launch. It went really well and I enjoyed myself. And I was on the subway platform and I was checking my email on my phone, and there was an email from a name I kind of recognized, but not 100%. And the subject heading was the real name of the company. And once I saw that, I was like, I know who that woman is. She had the cubicle next to mine.
Wow.
And she wasn't even portrayed in the book. I mean, so I didn't think this was the beginning of a like, you know, libel lawsuit or something. But I opened it and she said, hi, you know, it's been 25 years. I read your book, which it must have, I mean, it literally just came out. She said, I don't agree with the way you characterized everybody, but I certainly agree with the way you characterized the work. And then she said, it was pure and total bullshit. Like, what a waste of a life.
Wow.
And then she said, she sort of changed track. She said, I'm really glad that you've gone on to become a writer. I now work as a defense analyst with Northrop Grumman, the, you know, contractor. Oh, she said, God. She said, have a great day. And
that almost seems like a threat. Like, well, yeah, we're watching you.
No, but it was so interesting. Yeah. Because it's like, could I have taken her track? Maybe mm-hmm. so. Who am sure. I to say otherwise? Mm-hmm. You know? And she like, could I have characterized people in the book differently? Like, maybe, you know, but I love that she was like, we have taken such radically different paths. We have such radically different politics. And yet we can still recognize like the meaninglessness of so much of white collar work and therefore the meaninglessness of so much of our lives. Mm. You know, I forget what this was in answer to. So sorry about that. That's a long digression.
No. I was just talking about the way that, that these ideas, you know, reckoning with the ideas in can change you as a person.
Yes.
But it's interesting that like you're both reckoning with that idea and being changed in very
different ways.
But does that make very you feel ways. Like a determinist thing where it's like, well, trying to convince people to our side is pointless because they're just gonna come to the conclusions they come to no matter what. I don't know.
It's such an interesting question. You know, ostensibly I spend my life working as a professor whose job it is to help shape people's minds. A task I've mostly given up on. I think it's a problem. When I say I'm very interested in how people change, how people either come to think, wow, I was wrong or I wasn't wrong or maybe I was wrong. Like I'm talking about myself and my own political and intellectual development, but other people too. And it's, I don't have an easy answer. Like, is it, I can tell you that the past two books I've written, both Fake Work and the previous book that I wrote is called Marks for Cats. Mm-hmm. These are books which took ideas that I'm very interested in, you know, Marxism, work, labor, animal rights, the critique of political economy, and made them fun, or tried to make them fun. I shouldn't mm-hmm. say made them fun. Tried to make them fun, tried to make them pleasurable to see, could this allow a different kind of conversation? Like, I don't know if I'm going to convince somebody. I don't know if anybody put down Marx for Cats and said, bring animals onto our side in this political struggle. I'm done eating meat. I don't know that that happened, but I know as the result of that book and people reaching out to me that I've certainly been able to engage more people in the conversation than had I written another academic book or an academic article mm-hmm. about, you know, speciesism or veganism or what have you. So the reason I bring this up is to say, I don't know. I don't know about bringing people over to our side, but I do know that, you know, didacticism and sort of leftist politics as it's been practiced in the US, at least for the past, you know, 40 or 50 years, does seem to need an updating and does seem to need to have room for, you know, more pleasure, humor, joy, mm-hmm. Not as necessarily a site of political organizing, but as a site of openness to a new possibility of something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's return to the book for my final question here.
Okay.
The last question I like to ask people is to tell me about a memory where, and this is a new formulation that I have arrived at that is about to become updated because of reading your book. So the original question was, imagine you're in the afterlife where you get to pick one memory to relive anytime you want, whenever you want, however often.
Okay.
But then frequently enough for me to want to change it, people would question the mechanisms of reliving the memory. and brush up against, like, well, do I have my current mental state, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And
right.
So the way I've been asking it recently is, like, tell me about a memory where in the midst of it, you realized you were making a memory, where you were like having one of the moments of your life. And this is in your book that you talk about this word, which I will absolutely brutalize. Avanamentalizare. Tell me it. Just say it. Say it. Take, put me
Eventamentalizare.
Out of my misery. Eventamentalizare.
Like eventalism, to make yes. something an event.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so that is the actual question that I'm asking. It's like, tell me about a memory that was eventalized, that you remember becoming an event as it was happening.
You know, sorry to add to your troubles with this question by
no, please.
Giving you a whole new set of like mechanisms. But I think what you're asking is a self-consciousness at the point of memory.
I think a little bit, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But it was but from a positive standpoint of a like mm-hmm. where you're like, this is incredible that I'm having mm-hmm. the time of my life right now. Or like,
well,
yeah.
It's gonna tell you a lot about my relationship to my own anxiety, because it's another moment of the abatement of anxiety. And it's very picayune. I mean, it's very quotidian and banal. And but I don't know, 15 years or so ago, I don't know how long it was. I was in Mexico at an academic conference, and I got very sick. And for about 4 days, I was, you know, unable to eat, unable to drink. And I was, you know, had every possible stomach problem you can imagine. And on the fifth day, I realized I could eat again, and I could, relax that the illness had passed. And I just ate, you know, some white rice or something. I mean, not a lot, but just the feeling of having like calories, it produced a kind of relaxation. And it's like I was high just off being able to eat, but there was no desire for more. I mean, that was the most amazing moment. It was just like this moment of contentness. And I actually thought, as I like ate and the calories sort of went through my body, and I started to feel like at like myself again. And I thought, like, I don't think I've ever been this relaxed and this free from desire to do something, to have something, to move somewhere. The contentness of the moment, like as I am now. You know, it's something I've tried to return to in years of meditation and have never been able to approximate. Mm-hmm. So maybe the trick is to get like a horrible intestinal virus. and then, you know, on whatever day when you can eat some carbohydrates. But yeah, that would be the moment that comes to mind.
I love that. It seems the desire to approximate it through meditation seems doomed to failure because of the very desire to approximate it in
right,
the first
right.
place.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
That's lovely. And this question all came about through, because this podcast came from a one-man show that I did. The question came from my own memory. And I worked backwards to get the question. And the moment for me was a food moment as well. It was rapping in the car to a song I loved with a turkey sandwich that tasted really good in my mouth. And that's, yeah, there's something that's like so beautiful about you saying like the lack of desire for more is just like,
yeah.
Oh, like the freedom that,
yeah,
that,
yeah. And the present, just being in a present
mm-hmm.
and an experience of a present. Yeah.
I think that's a great, we've returned to anxiety here at
yeah.
the end and the dispelling of it. So thank you so much for doing this. This was like, I had a blast talking.
Me too. I had no idea what it was going to be about. I think I heard of your work from Michelle Kahara. Do you know her?
No.
She mentioned you as a few years ago, I was trying to do a night of Marxist humor like Marxist stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And she was like, he's a great leftist comedian.
Oh, that's
so you were already on my radar. That's what's so
really
interesting.
Kind. I would not have. Okay. Well, I love it.
Yeah. So I'm really glad to have gotten the chance to meet you. Do you ever get to New York?
Occasionally. It's been years, okay. But yeah, I would
love to.
Well,
give me a shout out if you do.
Definitely. How can people, other than fake work and going to Haymarket, what are the other ways that you'd like them to engage with your stuff online? Or from the library.
I run a socialist cat account called Marx for Cats at Instagram, where I just post socialist cats and communist cat memes. I don't have a huge online presence. They can check out my other books, Marx for Cats or Wages Against Artwork. I'm working on this new book now. I said about my mother and dementia and Michel Foucault, but that has a very long future ahead of it, future of writing ever make it into a store. I think the books are the best way. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you to folks for listening. Thank you again, Lee Claire. I also want to thank Matt Sage for the show's artwork. This is your Afterlife house band, Lake Mary, for the music. I don't run ads on the show, so the way to support the show and get all the bonus episodes, go to patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife. $5 a month gets you the whole bonus feed. $15 a month, you become a producer. And those people are Katie Llewellyn, Fred Fidowa, Shubha Singh, G, Debo, and Doc Lobster, MD. If you want to hit up the show via email, it's thisisyourafterlifepodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, remember, you are a mist.